Morning, Your Honors. Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, President Judge Vaughn, Justice Vaughn, perhaps for today. May it please the Court, this is the time set for oral argument in the appeal of BVF Partners LP, challenging the approval of a non-opt-out settlement in the matter of In Re Solera litigation, stockholders litigation. Subject to the Court's approval, I have asked to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
And the yellow light will come on when your reserve time begins.
Yes. Thank you. Your Honors, although we raise many separate points of error, this appeal could be resolved on the unified, limited basis that a plaintiff is not an adequate class representative where the following 9 points coalesce. One, the action is proposed to be conditionally certified for purposes of proposing a settlement. Two, the proposed conditional class certification lacks an opt-out right. Three, the conditionally certified action is proposed to be settled exclusively for non-monetary consideration. Four, the putative class representative is a frequent filer that sold the entirety of its shares into the market prior to the consummation of the merger challenged in the action. Five, the settlement agreement itself was not entered into until months after the class representative sold the entirety of its interest and this merger was consummated. Six, the settlement is opposed by the largest stockholder eliminated in the merger. Seven, even before selling its shares into the market, the putative class representative held only a nominal interest in the company that was dwarfed by the objector. Eighth, during the course of reviewing the discovery taken by the putative class rep, the objector uncovered a material valuation error committed by the investment bankers, which was not publicly disclosed prior to the merger's consummation, thereby supporting at minimum a quasi-appraisal claim for the class under Berger versus Pubco. And finally, the MOU that preceded the settlement agreement expressly authorized the class representative to refrain from entering into the settlement agreement if the class rep should determine that the settlement is not fair, reasonable, and in the best interests of the class.
Mr. Silverstein, yes, are you proposing this as a 9-point rule of law? Or
no.
Are these simply 9 equities that should weigh in favor of a determination that the court erred in finding that the plaintiff was not or was an adequate class representative?
Actually, I set forth in our briefs what we're proposing is that any one of those factors standing alone as a matter of law would compel the rejection of the settlement at minimum based on inadequacy of the class representative. However, in a case in which every one of those factors, and those are undisputed facts, every one of those factors coalesces, the class rep cannot be an adequate class representative to have certified conditionally a settlement on a non-opt-out basis for non-monetary consideration.
And does the record reflect when your client found out that the class representative had sold its stock?
We didn't find that out until discovery, and in fact, the discovery was discovery after the merger closed. We were now into objector discovery, which is limited to discovery of what the plaintiffs did in the action and some limited discovery about them themselves. They resisted providing us with their stock trading records, and we got them after we filed a motion to compel. So we respectfully submit that class certification would be improper if any one of those factors was present, but here they're all present. We also submit
Help me understand again, what is the new rule of law that you would have us adopt?
Your Honor, we would not have you adopt any new rule of law. We believe that the Court of Chancery failed to follow the law as it exists in numerous ways. The most significant one, and again, I believe that every one of these factors is important because adequacy is an important issue in class certification, and every one of these factors goes to the lack of adequacy. And
but is adequacy an issue of fact?
No, it's not, Your Honor. It's subject to de novo review by this court. The question of adequacy, it implicates the due process clause of the U.S. Constitution.
All right, so in that case, we're being told that the court erred as a matter of law for one of 9 reasons or for all of them combined?
There are, I think, 6 or 7 issues of law for which de novo review applies in this matter.
Let's go back to the beginning when the appointment of the class representative was made. Putting aside the sale of the stock, you're basically contending that the appointment should not have been made in the first place.
Your Honor, there was no appointment of a class representative until a year after this merger was consummated. The class certification did not occur, wasn't requested, until after the fact.
No, I understand.
So they were proceeding as if they were the class representative, but they weren't appointed by anybody other than themselves.
All right. So tell us, the focus of my question is, at the point in time when the Court of Chancery made a ruling, where did the Court of Chancery go wrong?
Okay, well, the Court of Chancery, when it made the ruling, was, and this is important because the procedural context at the time the certification occurs is important. So when the Court of Chancery was hearing certification question for the first time, the merger had already occurred nearly a year ago. The plaintiff had sold the shares before the merger had occurred. The settlement agreement that gave rise to the hearing wasn't entered into until many months after the merger was consummated and the plaintiff had sold its shares. The only thing that had occurred before the plaintiff sold its shares was the entry into a non-binding MOU, which had a fiduciary out. So that's the procedural context in which this occurred.
I'd like to just follow up on Justice Holland's question. If the plaintiff had moved to be certified as class representative shortly after the pleadings had been filed, would there have been any error in appointing that plaintiff class representative?
The plaintiff would have had standing. The class plaintiff would have had standing at that time.
The answer is there would have been no error?
We believe that there are discretionary issues that would have counseled against the appointment at that point, but they would not have been the legal errors that we're talking about today.
So it would have been, colloquially, okay at that point of time.
If we're only talking about the question of whether NORS could have been a class representative, we're not talking about whether it would be a non-opt-out class or anything else. Prior to the sale of their stock, leaving aside the issues of frequent filing, delegating authority to their lawyers, which wouldn't have occurred until afterwards, all of that, the legal argument that they would not have been a proper class rep would not be being made.
So it would follow, therefore, correct me if I'm wrong, that at some point along the line, after the pleadings were filed, the plaintiff would have ceased to be an adequate class representative.
Well, to the extent
at what point in the sequence of events would that be? What would be the earliest point?
To the extent that they were ever an adequate class representative, they as a matter of law, lost the ability to be such when they sold their shares into the market.
So that's the pivotal event?
It's the most significant event. I wouldn't want to concede that there weren't other issues with their class representative status, but that is the legal issue, as a matter of law, a legal issue.
All right, and that would have the sale of the stock took place after the MOU was executed, but before any settlement agreement was signed off and presented to the court.
That is correct. And not only that, the MOU, as I said, had a fiduciary out, but it also called for a settlement agreement to be entered into before the consummation of the transaction, and on a date that would have perhaps been before they sold their shares into the market. But for reasons that are unexplained, the parties never reached that settlement agreement. Prior to the consummation of the merger, they waited 3 months or 4 months to negotiate and execute that agreement.
Now, so the vice chancellor said, "I may well employ a more bright line test in the future." Would that be error to impose a bright line test, or are you asking us to establish a bright line test?
Well, I don't think we're asking you to establish anything, because the law could not be clearer that a shareholder, a former shareholder, that sold its shares into the market does not have standing to sue for monetary damages challenging a consummated merger. So there is a bright line rule in our law right now, which is that if you were a shareholder of a company and there has now been a merger, even though you were a shareholder while the merger was being put together pre-consummation, once that merger is consummated, you do not have standing to participate in a lawsuit to seek damages for breaches of fiduciary duty in connection with that transaction.
What would be your analysis if all the facts were the same except that the plaintiff had sold all but one of its shares, retaining that one share?
They would still have standing. I would contend that they're woefully inadequate as a discretionary matter, and they're still also inadequate legally for various other reasons here, including the non-opt-out status of the transaction, the type of settlement that they entered into. All those factors go into the analysis. They would still have standing.
Suppose they sold only 100 shares and retained the rest. Would they be adequate then?
Again, we believe they're inadequate for many reasons other than the sale of their stock. But the sale of their stock, as a matter of law, deprived them of standing, which made them necessarily inadequate, irrespective of any other reason that they were inadequate. So,
now, the Vice Chancellor seemed to recognize that as a general proposition, but then said in this case he was going to go forward anyway.
Well, that's because he believed wrongfully that he had discretion to allow a party that didn't have standing to proceed to be certified as a class representative and have a non-opt-out settlement approved over the objection of a significant stockholder.
And what is your position on what the Vice Chancellor should have done at that point in time?
Should have declined to certify Noors as a class representative, and since Noors was the only class representative being proffered to the court, the case should have proceeded.
Can we get to that issue for a moment? Because
yes,
it's my vague recollection that there were other plaintiffs, and because there was a consolidation or whatever earlier on, this plaintiff became the sole class representative. But in essence, if you had been successful in arguing that this plaintiff should not have been certified, that it would be a matter of form, pretty much, of putting in the other name.
Yeah, well, respectfully, I don't believe it's a matter of form, and I'll say that for two reasons. First off, they chose their class representative. The plaintiffs did. We sought discovery of these other putative class reps who were not being proffered. We were denied that discovery by the plaintiffs on the grounds that those people are irrelevant. We're not asking them to be certified. We don't even know the facts about those other plaintiffs because they told us you cannot have discovery about these other plaintiffs who are not being proffered as class representatives because they're not being proffered as class representatives. They did not sign the settlement agreement, and they were not proposing the settlement. Now, beyond that, there is no reason in the world, none, that someone who's not bound by that settlement agreement would now come before this court, the Court of Chancery, or any other court in the world, and say, we would like to have this case disposed of as against the class, grant a release to the defendants, and the class will receive nothing. Whatever they are going to get, they got.
Okay, let me go at it a different way. Let's say this court were to remand the case and tell the trial court this class representative is not adequate for the reason that
yes,
the representative did not own the stock, at which point I would assume a new class representative, one of these other people that maybe you didn't get discovery about, but a new person would or company would come forward as a class representative and would sign on to the settlement agreement. Why would we not, assuming for the moment that there were no infirmities in that party's conduct or ownership or whatever, why would that not resolve the problem?
It is inconceivable. First of all, our client would wish to step into that position, and Chancery Court decisions state that an objector who succeeds in opposing a settlement should become the class representative if they wish to do so, and we would. But beyond that, it's inconceivable that there could ever be, in the facts of this case, an adequate class representative who would step into the shoes of this one that's disqualified and then sign on to the settlement agreement. The mere fact that they would sign on to this agreement now, not historically, but now, when there would be nothing to be gained for the class whatsoever, other than they would be subjected to a release, would make them inadequate. It's inconceivable that there could be a rational reason for any class representative to now want to be a proponent of this settlement, other than to get their lawyers paid, because they get nothing else.
All right, so your client, if your client, in the hypothetical posed by Justice Berger, were to come forward in the Court of Chancery to take over the case as class representative, it would not be for purposes of presenting a settlement.
Absolutely not.
For purposes of prosecuting a damages action.
Absolutely. That's been their objective all along. So is it the question of whether NORS had lost its standing to proceed by selling its stock is a question of law subject to de novo review. There's no dispute about that. It's incomprehensible to me how the court below found that they could somehow recover monetary damages if the settlement didn't occur and the case proceeded to a damage proceeding, because it's never occurred in the history of Delaware. Every judgment that's been entered post-trial in a post-merger dispute over breaches of fiduciary duty has gone exclusively to stockholders of record on the day the merger closed. Didn't matter whether they held shares when the merger was announced, and the people that held shares when the merger was announced didn't receive a penny. These class representatives, these lawyers, have settled cases in the last 2 years in which excess consideration was paid following the consummation of a merger that was challenged for breach of fiduciary duty. The merger consideration went exclusively to stockholders of record on the day the merger was closed. And I have to believe that they would have arranged for payment to be made to former stockholders who were stockholders when the deal was announced if they truly believed that those persons had standing to possibly collect a portion of those damages. I find it fascinating. We learned yesterday for the first time that I'm into my rebuttal. And
would you like to save that?
I would like to save that.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Stuart Grant. I'd like to just take 2 minutes to kind of set the stage of what's really going on here, because I think the Court may not be being told what's really happening. First, New Orleans, Knowers, was approved as lead plaintiffs at the outset. Order signed. So the idea that no one ever made them, they were just acting, is just not true. Second, let's talk briefly about the settlement and then the objectors, and then
The date of that order, Mr. Grant?
I don't have it, but it's part of the record, and I have no doubt that one of my team will hand it to me sometime during the discussion. Okay. The gravamen of the complaint was that the sale process to Quest was faulty. The settlement fixes that, and it fixes it as well as anyone could. In fact, what the court below said, I'm told April 1st, I guess that would be 2011. What the court below said was if the plaintiffs were successful at trial, the relief that I would give is very close to what was actually gotten in the settlement. It was to fix the process. It wasn't to get monetary damages. It was to fix the process so that one of the five most likely suitors would be released from their obligation not to bid. They had already done due diligence. We would reduce the transaction fees, meaning the breakup fee, to make it easier for them to bid. And that's the way to maximize value. It's not this bogus, non-monetary. It's here's the problem, we fixed the problem, now let the market tell you what it's really worth, because if they're really underpaying, if Quest is really underpaying, then someone else will come in and buy it for more. That's what we did. Now, interesting enough, while this was happening, BBF was helping us because they were out in the market trying to solicit bidders. So in effect, although we were working in parallel, we were working together. Everyone understood that what the goal was to try to get a higher bidder for the company. The settlement facilitates that. Now, when the settlement was reached, the MOU executed, which, by the way, I don't know why they say it's non-binding. They say it's binding, but it's got a fiduciary out. That's still a binding agreement. So the MOU was reached and executed. New Orleans is a shareholder. BVF is a shareholder. When the settlement agreement is fully executed and negotiated out, New Orleans is not a shareholder, but neither is BVF. The only shareholder is Quest. And that is a situation when I get further on and we're going to discuss what Mr. Silverstein's rule of law will do to the ability to settle cases in Delaware and therefore the ability to bring cases in Delaware, it'll be devastating. But we'll talk about what he wants to do. But first, I just need to speak a moment about the objector. There is no doubt that BVF is a very, very large shareholder. So what could it do? The first thing it could have done was intervened right at the beginning. It knew this case was there, but it was trying to sandbag. So it was more than happy to let New Orleans move forward and try to accomplish its goal of fixing the process. And had they found a higher bidder, or we found a higher bidder, or had a higher bidder just come in, they would have been happy as anything to take the extra money, as would we, and they wouldn't be here. They're sandbagging. And what happens is, approximately a week before the settlement is reached, the plaintiff's lawyers contact BVS lawyers and say, we're getting ready to reach a settlement. It's non-monetary. And this is an affidavit that's in the record that discusses this by Mr. Lubavitch. It says, we're getting ready for a non-monetary settlement. This is what we'll do. Can we have your client's reaction to it? Are you with us or against us? And they didn't say a word because they were happy to accept the benefits and sit quietly to see if it works by freeing these five likely bidders, by reducing the breakup fee, to see if that would get a higher price. It was only when it failed to get a higher price that they said, oh, well, now we object. They're willing to get the benefits, and if you read throughout their brief, there's a recurrent theme which says you should have reneged on giving them the release, even though all plaintiffs got the benefits, but when the benefits didn't work out the way we wanted to, you should have reneged. That's their argument. And they asked for equity based on that argument. Now, what else could BVF have done? They could have sought appraisal. They're not a small shareholder where appraisal was a remedy that wouldn't be economically feasible. They had, at the end, 25% of a company. They certainly had enough shares to make that economically worthwhile. And in the record, Your Honors, they have said that they publicly pledged to seek appraisal. Publicly pledged. But then what happened was they withdrew that appraisal petition and accepted the merger consideration. Why? If they truly believed it was worth more, why go through the breach of fiduciary duty? Why don't you just say it's a valuation issue? We've got it all. We don't need a class action. We don't need anything. We have our appraisal remedy.
Mr. Grant, can you wrap that story into some sort of legal argument?
Yes, I think the legal argument is before you come into court and ask for equity, one must do equity. And what they're doing here is they're saying they need to get the benefits. They want to get the benefits. They want to see how the benefits play out. And then they want to say, oh, they didn't play out the way I wanted to.
But you're not talking about unclean hands or that kind of rule, are you? Or
well,
estoppel. I mean,
to some extent, that is what I'm talking about. Where they're seeking to invoke equity, and yet they haven't done equity.
Was that argued to the Vice Chancellor, what you're arguing to us?
In different words, I think it was. I think it was pointed out what they were trying to do.
Well, what does equity have to do with standing?
Well, there's no doubt that they're standing. We are a member of the class. There's no doubt they're standing. Well, their real argument is whether there's adequacy. Because if they're talking about standing, then they're really talking about derivative actions. The class is defined, and they haven't disagreed with the class. We're a member of the class. And I guess it's important now to put something in perspective. Because Knowers, New Orleans, did sell its shares at a premium to the merger price 2 business days before the squeeze-out merger took place. That's all we're talking about, 2 business days. Prior to that time, when the tender offer took place, they didn't tender. Okay, so they landed with the tender offer. They didn't tender. BVF didn't tender. New Orleans didn't tender. Then it was announced by Quest that they were going to do a squeeze-out merger. 2 business days prior to the squeeze-out merger, for some bizarre reason, BVF is in the market buying up all the shares it can. And therefore, it actually drove the price above the merger price. So New Orleans is sitting there and saying, well, I can wait 2 days, and the squeeze-out is going to take place, and I'm going to lose my shares for $18 a share, or I can sell today at $18.05.
So you're, the other side was content to sit back and hope to get the benefit of your client's efforts to fix the process.
Correct.
And your client was content to sit back and let the other side drive up the price and then take advantage of that by selling their stock at a premium above the merger price.
No, quite the contrary. We didn't know what they were doing. We didn't know that they'd be out there buying. So we actually did the work to try to get them a benefit. They, for some reason, and to no one understands why, were out there buying more shares, even though a squeeze-out merger had already...
Well, there was a 13D on file on the day that your client sold its stock, was there not?
And yes, absolutely.
I have to assume that your client had access to that.
Yes.
And it showed that there was a... that the objectors were buying a lot of stock, had a big holding.
In the past, the 13D did not show that they were buying shares after it was announced that there was going to be a squeeze-out merger in 2 days at a fixed price. Well, and so what happens is... I'm sorry.
Let me pursue it a little bit differently. 2 days before the merger, your client sells because the market price is above the merger price.
Correct.
Okay. If the market price is above the merger price, doesn't that suggest that the merger price is inadequate?
No, it suggests an anomaly because their client is in the market buying up shares.
But doesn't it happen on more than one occasion that the market responds to a transaction by demonstrating its belief that eventually there will be a higher price?
No, not in this case, not when it's one buyer that's causing it. This isn't the collective thought. This is one buyer who, by the way, may have been rational if they continue to move forward and do their appraisal action. But they don't. So I'd like to now trend into the rule of law that you're being asked to do. So to support its first argument that Knowers couldn't get damages as a matter of law because it sold 2 days before the squeeze out, BVF cites to one of my cases, Del Monte. And BVF is right. In that case, the plan of allocation provided damages to those who held on a merger date. But what BVF fails to tell you is that this court approved damages to holders who sold before the merger in Philadelphia Stock Exchange. And Mr. Silverstein, on behalf of the defendants in the ACS case and in the Landry's case, agreed to plans of allocation which provided for monetary damages to people who sold before the merger closed, not just on the day of the merger. So if we're pointing at look what they did once and look what they did once, there's no rule of law that says a plan of allocation can't allocate damages to people who sold before the merger. There's just simply no rule of law like that. And in fact, many courts have allowed that to happen. The second and more important argument, I think, is that BVF needs to show, says that New Orleans didn't own shares at the time the settlement agreement was signed and therefore didn't have standing. If Your Honor rewrites Delaware law to say that, you will eviscerate the ability to settle merger and acquisition cases. And let me explain why. It is the general practice in M&A litigation that if what you're going to do is change the process, or potentially even change the price, that is done based on an MOU. And the benefits that the plaintiff class gets are immediate. You can have certain restrictions drop, you can have a price change, you can have all these things that happen. And then what happens, particularly if it's a tender offer, the tender offer may be extended 10 days, and the deal is done.
Mr. Grant, if I understand the objector's position correctly, their response to that argument would be, it may be because of the dynamics of the transaction and its interaction with the litigation, the merger may well have to close before the court can rule on the settlement. But a settlement agreement could nonetheless, that is a binding formal settlement agreement could have been presented to the court, and the court could have been apprised of what was going on, and then the matter would have been in a different procedural posture.
They say that, but it's not true. So, for example, I've got a case right now in which we settled for lots of changes to the terms of the merger based on an MOU. And by the way, a binding MOU. I don't know why there's this belief that an MOU is not binding, particularly where one party already performs and it's an executory contract. But the MOU is performed under, the benefits are given to the class, and often it takes 2 or 3 weeks to draft all of the papers because, as your honors know, it also includes a notice, a final judgment, and many other ancillary papers. That frequently takes 2 to 3 weeks, which means they're not even signed and originally presented to the court until after the tender offer is closed or the squeeze-out merger or whatever it might be. And so these things are routinely done based on MOUs with the idea that once the court approves it, that everyone is going to fulfill their obligations. Because if the rule of law, if Silverstein on law is true, then what happens is everyone, no one will do a deal anymore, because what will happen is that the plaintiff class will get all the benefits. Then when it's time to perform, either the plaintiff will say, well, I'm not performing, or better yet, I'll just sell my shares, or I don't even have to sell my shares because you did a squeeze-out merger, so I don't have shares anymore. Because I don't have shares, I don't have standing, therefore I have to withdraw. There is no benefit anymore to us continuing on, and I get all the benefits of the settlement without having to give the releases. Well, that's great once. After that, defense counsel becomes too smart, and they say, well, I'm not going to do a deal with you because there's no way we can do this deal because you will, you're not going to have shares at the end when the settlement comes up for approval, and therefore you don't have standing,
well,
or you're not adequate.
Can't that be included in the MOU that they will continue to own their shares?
Oh, the Silverstein 9 binding MOU or the MOU?
Your MOU. That's
my right. MOU? The problem with my MOU is we're going to do the deal based on that, and you're going to take all my shares in the tender offer. I'm not going to have any shares left. In the same way, they didn't have any shares left.
But they didn't have any shares left because they sold them, not because of the merger.
No, they didn't have any shares
left.
We sold ours 2 days before the merger.
Right.
But even if we held on those 2 days, we still wouldn't have had shares at the time that the settlement agreement was signed, at the time that it was approved by the court, or anything. We wouldn't have had shares. This is a red herring. In almost all these transactions, you can't own shares at the time the settlement agreement is signed, and certainly at the time that the approval is gotten.
But what about at the time of the merger?
At the time of the merger?
Mm-hmm.
You can own shares, but if the tender offer is already completed and it's a squeeze-out merger, what is significant about that? Nothing. There's nothing that has to be done. We're talking about adequacy. The adequacy is, do you have the economic interest so that it's not collusive?
Remind me of the date of the MOU in relation to the merger.
The MOU is signed on April 18th. BVF notifies the court of its intention to object to the settlement on May 2nd. The tender offer minimum condition is satisfied on May 3rd. Quest closes a subsequent offering period on May 10th. On May 11th, Quest says that they're going to effect the short-form merger. May 13th, Nowhere sells. May 17th, the short-form merger is consummated.
So about a month's difference. And as I understand your argument, and based on the MOU, which took place before the merger, things actually happened that changed the way the merger process work that benefited everyone.
Yes, and those benefits were given, were provided back in April, because that's when the tender offer was extended, the conditions were dropped, others were allowed to come in and potentially bid. All those benefits came in before the tender offer was ever completed. So we got all the benefits.
So the fact, in your opinion, that the settlement took place after the merger is insignificant as a matter of law, because as a matter of law, you accomplished everything you could before the merger took place.
Exactly. And in fact, it's an executory contract. We got all the benefits. The only thing was left for us to perform. And they say, aha, it makes no sense for you to perform because you've gotten all the benefits. Yeah, well, that is a way of thinking about it. One of the other interesting things is, because once again in the papers and throughout, Mr. Silverstein takes cheap shots at us because, you know, we're only doing this for our fee. And, you know, we're a bunch of contingent fee lawyers, which, of course, it's humorous since the largest contingent fee practice, as Your Honor knows, is Young Conaway's practice in the personal injury field. And, in fact, the head of the trial lawyers is a partner of theirs. I'd like to see them show their brief to Tim. But in any event, we got the benefit for the class. It was a contested fee hearing. So even if the settlement fell apart, we would still be entitled to a fee, and we would still make the same argument the defendants would oppose us. So the idea that somehow our fee is driving what we did post-merger just makes no sense. There's no economic logic behind it. All we're doing is honoring.
Just so we can focus on the legal arguments, one of the arguments made against you related to standing, your answer to that is you have standing because you're in the class as the class was defined.
Correct.
Then the fallback argument on the other side is you might have standing, but you were an inadequate representative. And your answer to that is the substance of the MOU demonstrates why
we got,
you were adequate.
Exactly. We got everything we got, and those 2 days that we were not shareholders that they were, nothing happened.
Remind me, how was the class defined?
It was all shareholders other than the defendants who, and I have to be careful because I know the exact definition, from the date that the merger was first announced through the closing.
Your client was, I see, all right.
All shareholders at any time during that.
Okay.
So that's another thing. If Your Honor's rule in favor of Mr. Silverstein, then once again, what you're going to have is we're not going to be able to define classes that way. And often, the class is defined before the merger settles. So what are we going to say? It's just all people who are shareholders on the very last day? And by the way, if I'm approving the settlement before the merger closes, I don't know if you're ever going to be in that class because I don't know if you'll hold those shares on the last day. It's a disaster, his suggested rule of law. You will never have another settlement in Delaware on a merger and acquisition case, and you'll never see another case brought in Delaware because of that.
That's pretty hyperbolic.
It's true.
We won't have another appeal like this.
You won't. You won't.
So are you, is that?
I think there's some time.
Is that,
I don't know if
that to be encouraging to us that we won't.
It may be. It may be, but of course it would be devastating to Delaware that other states would wind up deciding Delaware cases because we couldn't settle here because of this rule that you had to be a shareholder at the time of the merger, and the merger could either take place after the approval, in which case no one would have ever finality, or the benefits would be given before that final date.
But before you sit down, just on that point, your focus is we really ought to look at the way the class is defined and not talk about holding stock on the date of the merger. The focus should be on were you a stockholder as the class is defined.
That's the only standing question, and that's an easy question. Then the next question is one of fact and judgment. Are you adequate? And by that, you have to look at a number of factors, which the Vice Chancellor did, and that, of course, is an abuse of discretion. He looked at all the right factors and said, yes, you adequately protected the class.
All right. Thank you.
Can I step in here? On your doom and gloom comments, the Court of Chancery noted three decisions, at one going back to 2011, that according to the court said that you have to be dismissed summarily for selling your shares. And those cases do not appear to have destroyed the merger and acquisition settlement world.
If you look at them, those are taken out of context. So let me tell you the one that's easiest for me because I was there. So one out of six plaintiffs was dismissed. One out of six lead plaintiffs was dismissed in the clothing one. What's it? J. Crew. Down with their stuff, so I don't remember that. So that had no effect. The other one was someone who was actually insider trading before any settlement was reached, but he was insider trading during the time period that he was getting confidential information and trading on that. And he actually didn't sell out his whole position, but he was shorting stock as part of a deal.
So you're saying that in these other cases, the Court of Chancery did not trigger the doomsday machine?
They didn't. If what you say is you have to be a shareholder on the very last day to be able to do something, and the settlement is going to occur before then, you will never know if this person ever had standing or not, or if they were adequate, because you're going to say, well, I'm closing the deal, I'm closing everything, but I'm not going to know who's in there until the future. But and there's too much damage that can be caused.
Your takeaway, if I understand it correctly, in your response to Justice Holland's question, is that this is really not an issue of standing. If there is an issue, it's one of adequacy. Adequacy is a discretionary determination, and that's the standard under which we have to review that claim.
Exactly.
All right. Do you have any other questions? Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, Brian Polivoy on behalf of Quest Diagnostics and Solera Corporation. I will be brief. Court of Chancery properly certified the class under B1A, B1B, and B2, and it did not abuse its discretion in denying BVF's request to opt out of the class. I would be particularly...
And the certification included the definition that Mr. Grant was just describing.
It was, I don't have the words in front of me, but yes, he paraphrased it well. It's up through the date of the closing.
The argument that we're confronted with is that the court at that stage was either obligated as a constitutional matter to certify the class as a B3 class, or in the proper exercise of its discretion should have, if it's certified under subsection B2, should have made it an opt-out B2 class. What is your response to that?
Mr. Silverstein said, quote, "We would not have you adopt any new rule of law. We would not have you adopt any new rule of law." He said today, he's not asking this court to adopt a new rule of law. Nottingham Partners, this court's decision, says explicitly that a B2 certification is appropriate in circumstances like this.
That was quite a different case, factually. I was the trial judge in that one, and my colleague to my right wrote the opinion on appeal. It was a securities disclosure litigation.
Correct. But in the many years since then, every time where a case is brought that is predominantly for injunctive and declaratory relief, the Court of Chancery has approved B2 settlements.
Well, is it not the case that your position or your client's position is rooted on the premise that in certifying a class under Rule 23, the court looks to the class at the time the complaint was filed and not at the time that the motion to certify is filed?
Well, in a settlement class, there is a difference, Your Honor.
It was the entire
time in this case from when it was filed until the settlement was reached, the settlement being reached at the MOU, this case was primarily for injunctive and declaratory relief.
Now, you're answering me factually, and I'm asking you
the answer is no to your question. We are not suggesting that it is determined simply by what the complaint says when it is filed.
Then why should the court not have certified the class based on the realities on the ground at the time the motion was presented as part of the settlement?
Okay. When it is a settlement class, as you heard before, the deal is going to close based on the MOU. At all times from when the complaint was filed, as the case was prosecuted through discovery, through the preliminary injunction briefing, up until the date where the parties signed a binding MOU, it was at that time a case for primarily injunctive and declaratory relief. It is correct that after that, the deal closes based on that MOU, subject, of course, to the Court of Chancery finding that the settlement is fair. But to hold that we are going to wait until the determination by the Court of Chancery as to whether it is fair, to hold that we are going to say on that day we are going to determine whether the case as it existed today is primarily for declaratory relief would mean the deals can't close. One can't go forward with a corporate transaction until months later, because even if a settlement agreement...
The deal closed quite a bit of time before the court was asked to rule on the settlement.
Well,
and the argument that was made before the court and is being made to us is, by the objectors, is, look, we own a large percentage of the stock of this company. We believe that the merger price was unfairly low. The only consequence of certifying this class as a settlement class would be to bless giving of releases to the defendants. There's nothing in it for the shareholders because they've already got that benefit. All that's left to be done is to prosecute a claim for damages, and we're prepared to do that. Why shouldn't the court, at least as a matter of discretion, under subsection B2, certify on that basis, or under B3?
First, factually, to some of your points, Your Honor, when the MOU was reached on Saturday, April 18th, it was sent to the Court of Chancery that day. This was not a question that the Vice Chancellor did not see this proposed settlement until months later. He was advised, because he had a preliminary injunction hearing, fully briefed, getting ready to hear it in days, and he was told the parties are pleased to agree this is the settlement they have reached. here are the benefits that are going to go to the class, here are the terms of the deal, and the MOU and the settlement agreement, Your Honor, are the same. Save, they keep on trying to talk about the indication of a settlement versus the final agreement. Other than the notice to the class and all the ancillary documents which take...
Are you saying that the Court of Chancery discontinued the preliminary injunction hearing based on the party's representations that it had been settled?
Yes. Yes.
I know the chronology supports that logically.
Yeah, a letter was written to the Vice Chancellor saying the parties have reached a settlement and therefore the plaintiff said we do not need to go forward with the preliminary injunction. Our clients, the defendants, then filed the various forms, amended their merger agreement, went through all of the terms, the consideration they were given. And as to your second factual point, Your Honor, it is true that their plaintiff sold on Friday, I believe it was May 13th. BVF only owned its shares for about 36 more business hours. It was on the Tuesday, you know, after Monday, once Quest said it's going to exercise, it's going to exercise the top-up. It already said before it's going to exercise the top-up. It was a fait accompli, and a day later, they lost their shares. I'm not here to
It may be true that both sides acted opportunistically, which often happens when millions of dollars are at stake. But we're being asked to make legal sense of this.
I understand. And legally, on that point, the nine-point plan that we heard, those are facts. And that is what the Vice Chancellor below heard. And what he looked at is 20 years or more of precedent that says in these types of cases where the complaint primarily seeks injunctive and declaratory relief, and when you look at the relief requested of this complaint, it is plain beyond peradventure that that's what it seeks, that in those circumstances, a B2 or a B1A certification is appropriate. My last factual point, Your Honor, in the reply brief, there is a Supreme Court case to which they cite the Fiberboard case. It is misquoted. Three words are added into their quote from a Supreme Court case which changed the holding of those cases, I'm sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That last statement was true. It certainly was not intentional, and we will look at that after the argument.
Could you start with the clear up for us your argument about standing?
Yes.
You're talking about selling the stock. If the class is defined in a way where you own stock and you're in the class, is your real argument that they were an inadequate representative or they somehow are out of the class?
No, neither. Our argument is that they had no standing to prosecute this action if there were no settlement, and therefore they cannot be, as a matter of law, an adequate class representative. Yes, there are members of the class. This court knows, especially those who have been on the Court of Chancery, classes are defined broadly so that the release that is obtained in the settlement or the resolution of the case can apply broadly. But members of that defined class don't necessarily have claims. It is often the case, as evident by every one of these judgments I recited and every one of the settlements that I discussed before, the classes in every one of those cases are all stockholders who held from the date of the announcement of the transaction through the consummation. Judgment, however, or settlement goes to the people who were stockholders on the day the merger closed. Claims, to the extent there are any, that evaporated when the shares were sold are barred in the release, and those people are therefore part of the class. They have standing to object. They'll lose their objection on the basis that the settlement only wipes out a claim they don't really have in the first place. That's been held by the Court of Chancery repeatedly. I believe this court has even affirmed that rationale. But a stockholder, a former stockholder, that tries to obtain damages for a breach of fiduciary duty giving rise to a merger won't get them if they sold their shares into the market before the transaction was consummated. That's black letter law. Now, I stand corrected.
So, let's go back to what we heard from your opponent about the fact that there was this preliminary injunction, the memorandum of understanding was submitted to the court, and a letter was submitted that we settled.
Yes.
For all intents and purposes, we have a de facto settlement subject to paperwork. Is that true? And if it is true, does it make a difference?
It's not true, and it doesn't make a difference. The factual recitation is accurate. The chronology is accurate. The court was not asked to do anything. The court was told the parties are taking the motion for preliminary injunction off the table. The court was informed that there was an MOU. court wasn't asked, does this make sense to you? Does this MOU look like it's the kind of thing which, when reduced to a settlement, the court will have the will wish to approve or be willing to approve? Vice Chancellor Lamb criticized this procedure years earlier. He said, if you have to, because of the exigencies, and it often is the case, if you have to settle but you don't have time to get the notice out and don't have time to get formal court approval prior to the consummation of your transaction, you should ask the court for preliminary approval. Telling the court that you have settled and you're withdrawing your motion is not asking the court for anything. Courts are busy. When courts are told a motion is being taken off the table, court's very happy. I no longer have a motion on the table that I have to decide. The court's not being asked. There's not a motion to take the motion off the table. The motion's been withdrawn. It's a unilateral act of the parties. And it's purely sloppy that they didn't have a settlement agreement prior to the date that this transaction closed. They committed in the MOU to have a settlement agreement before the transaction closed. I've been involved in numerous settlements where we had settlement agreements, not MOUs, before the transaction closed. So this is just nonsense that's being given to the court.
Is it your position then that, as a matter of at least good practice, that the settlement hearing and everything should have occurred before the merger?
Well, if that were possible, if this court has said so in Barkan. In the Barkan decision, the Court of Chancery, Vice Chancellor Lamb decision, and the SS&C case said that that would be the optimal practice. Both of those cases recognize that there can be exigencies that would prevent that from happening. A merger typically is that kind of a situation. But the court can be preliminarily requested to eyeball the proposed settlement and determine whether it's one that makes sense to stop the proceedings, not simply told by the parties, we've decided to stop.
Well, wouldn't the court have done that in this case?
If it
ultimately approved it later, it would have approved it up front?
It's anyone's guess what the court would have done a year earlier based on a less developed factual record. I don't know the answer to that. I do want to acknowledge, by the way, that I stand corrected that there was an initial order signed. That was Mr. Grant made that point. I had told the court earlier that the class rep was not appointed by anybody. What happens at the beginning of all these representative cases is the class representative, the class plaintiff submits a consented to order to the court that makes them the provisional class representative until such time as they're actually requested for certification, and the court signs that order as a matter of course. That did occur. BVF wasn't happy to have this case brought. BVF didn't sit back.
Did you have the opportunity to object to that appointment?
No, we weren't involved in the case.
So it was done without your knowledge, or you just weren't involved?
My law firm was not involved. My client didn't have representation that was focusing on this litigation at that time. I mean, I guess if we were monitoring the filings in a proceeding, which are not made publicly available, you know, they're not publicized. There's no notice sent out to the class members that a class action has begun and this order has been entered. If you monitor the Court of Chancery filings, you could find it out, but there's no reason for somebody to be doing that in general. We did not know that it occurred. It's not something we would have objected to because it wasn't our lawsuit. And that's the point I'm coming to. BVF didn't sit back and say, we're happy to have you prosecute this action. There's no record of that. BVF didn't want this action to proceed. BVF was content to see what would happen in the marketplace, unimpeded by this, what they viewed to be frivolous injunction application that was going to either be rejected. In fact, Vice Chancellor Parsons said he would have probably rejected it, or at most given them the relief they got preliminarily.
Mr. Grant tells us that, while this action was pending, your client was out trying to encourage other potential bidders. Number one, is that correct? And number two, if it is correct, was your client aware of what was going on in the litigation, at least at that point in time?
Client was trying to dissuade Solera from going forward on the financial terms that they were going forward on. Wasn't trying to solicit other bidders. Our client believes that this company was worth multiples.
The answer is they were trying to solicit other bidders.
I'm not sure there's a record they were trying to solicit other bidders. They were buying shares themselves, which if more shares they held, the less shares would be tendered to support the transaction. They were making publicly known their view that this transaction was a bad transaction in the hope that stockholders would not tender or support the transaction. I don't believe there's a record that they were actually soliciting other bidders. That may have been a consequence of the actions they were taking, but I don't believe that is what the record
is. That's not a record fact.
I don't believe it is. And again, we're sandbagging. We didn't want this preliminary injunction application. What happens time and time again is that the shareholder plaintiffs bring these preliminary injunction applications. They don't get a preliminary injunction. They settle. They often settle for therapeutics. Our client isn't interested in therapeutics. Our client is interested in money. They have a $150 million investment in this company. They believe it's worth multiples of that. They've been denied an opportunity to even file a complaint and proceed to see if it can get past a 12B6 motion, because the court in its discretion found that their claim would not be all that good. In the Schultz decision on the standing case, Schultz, which this court had, involved a consummated transaction, and it wasn't a merger. It was a consummated reorganization. People sold their shares after the wrongful act had already occurred, and they weren't denied standing. That makes perfect sense. ACS is the only settlement that they've identified. I see my time is up, and unless the court has any questions, I will sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the record site that you're looking for is at A3223 to A3233, in which, quote, DBF would, quote, continue discussions with third parties regarding alternatives to this transaction, including but not limited to the submission of a superior proposal for all or part of the company. That's out of their 13D.
Thank you all for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.